to Utah Beach, to put it to the touch, to win or lose it all. Not much was expected of Army's 1953 team. Six players, including the most talented back, Freddie Myers, had been lost to academic failure. Would those setbacks have been avoided if the Corps still passed the poop? Perhaps, perhaps not. But in a sense, the team rendered that question irrelevant by playing above its abilities. Blake sensed during fall practice that his players were gelling. "We are off to a good start in the face of some personnel problems," he wrote to MacArthur in his preseason letter. And the players, for their part, noticed that the coaches, especially Lombardi, had even more emotion than usual invested in the team's fortunes. Although Blake was a proponent of two-platoon football, his squad clearly benefited from rules changes making substitutions more difficult in 1953, essentially going back to the days of 60-minute men. This placed more emphasis on discipline and conditioning, the two areas where all Army teams were unmatched. The cadets defeated Furman in the opener 41-0, the most decisive win and first shutout since before the 1951 scandal. They were on their way to a win in the second game against Northwestern of the Big Ten, but were done in by two fumbles near the end zone and a dropped interception, which might have cost them three touchdowns and made the difference in a 33-20 loss. Lombardi took the loss especially hard, Blake later recounted. Vince was crying in the dressing room because individual mistakes had cost the game for a bunch of kids who had worked so hard to come out of nowhere. Army rebounded in unexpected fashion, playing out the rest of the season unbeaten, with a lone, scoreless tie against talented Tulane, whose star back was a future Green Bay Packer named Max McGee, and a stunning 20-7 victory over powerful Navy in the year-ending rivalry. It was the first cadet win over the midshipmen since 1949, and it brought with it a host of rewards. Service Academy bragging rights, a prized watch inscribed A20, N7, 1953, that the players wore proudly for the rest of their lives. The Lambert Trophy as the best team in the East, and some National Coach of the Year honors for Red Blake. But the upset over Navy was not the turning point. The emotional high in a passionate season had come earlier, in the heat of middle October, when Army played at the Polo Grounds against Duke, a national power, then ranked number 7, with a brilliant backfield led by Red Smith and Worth a Million Lutz. On the eve of the season, Blake had met privately with 45 cadet captains and pleaded with them to help restore the academy to the days when the football team received unqualified support, a final reconciliation after years of estrangement. Team and Corps needed to come together, Blake told the captains, not just for competitive spirit, but for a regaining of a soul for the academy. The Duke game accomplished what words alone could not. The entire Corps, 2,400 strong, rode down to New York for the game and stood as a thunderous wave of blue-gray, screaming from the moment the team set foot on the field until the final gun. The players gave them plenty to shout about. Tommy Bell plowing up the middle for the first score. Quarterback Pete Van ambidextrously switching the ball from right hand to left to make a crucial southpaw toss, leading to a second score. Duke missing an extra point that would have tied the game at 14-all. It was a game worthy of golden-era sports writing, and Red Smith was there for the New York Herald Tribune to record the final act, which starred, felicitously, the Duke back of the same name. The score held at 14-13 as the fourth quarter rolled out, and up in the press box, historians burrowed in the records, hunting another Army victory as unexpected as this. They couldn't find one. Then, suddenly, it appeared such comparisons would be vain, for here was Duke clamoring for another touchdown. There was a double reverse behind the line of scrimmage, and Red Smith broke free, pursued only by Bob Mishak, a frustrated back who plays end and third base at West Point. Smith had a lead of at least 8 yards when the pursuit began, but Smiths simply aren't fast. 73 yards down the field, Mishak had him by the neck and dragged him to earth, 7 yards from the goal line. In truth, sportswriter Smith underplayed Mishak's accomplishment at the expense of an irresistible joke about the running abilities of anyone named Smith. No one on the field or the sidelines expected Mishak to catch him. Jerry Lodge, pursuing from his linebacker spot, was 10 yards behind Mishak as they ran after Smith and was shocked that his teammate made the tackle, one that he could remember vividly nearly a half century later. He grabbed Smith on top of the shoulder pads and pulled him straight down. The runner and all of us were so surprised. Duke had 4 downs to score from there and bulled closer every time. On 4th down with 2 yards to go, Worth Lutz pounded forward on a quarterback sneak, and when the referee cleared the pile, he'd been stopped inches from the goal line. Blake, fearful of a fumble, ordered a quick kick on 1st down and sent his defense out again for a final stand in its own territory. 40 seconds left. Cadets streamed down the stands and gathered on the far sideline and behind the end line. Duke threw 4 straight passes, the last one broken up in the end zone. Suddenly, wrote Red Smith, the stained white jerseys of the West Point team disappeared, swamped under wave upon wave of blue-gray soldier suits. West Point cadets never break ranks. This time, they practically broke their heroes to pieces. When Bob Mishak made that unlikely play, what Blake called a marvelous display of heart and pursuit, Army's football team regained its soul. Not just Lombardi, but all the coaches, even the stoic colonel, cried in the locker room after the game, and it was difficult at that moment to dispute that MacArthur was right. There was no substitute for victory. Not victory for its own sake. Victories of this sort brought deeper feelings for the game, for the school, for the team, for the human spirit. Tim Cohane was there with his young boys, who remembered the scene forever. Blake smiling, a sight they had rarely seen before, and Lombardi roaring and shaking with laughter. For the athletes, this was the reason they played, this moment. Sitting there exhausted in the dusty old dressing room above the south end of the field, lockers clanging, rounds of on brave old Army team echoing in the din, T-shirts soaked with burning sweat sticking to their backs like extra layers of skin, and here comes Vince, beaming, holding scissors, shouting, "We're gonna cut 'em off, men!" Cut off the T-shirts. It was an honor, a symbolic gesture signifying that Blake and Lombardi and their boys had everything to look forward to, even though they had nothing left to give. Chapter 9. Cult of the New. Far off, I hear the rolling, roaring cheers. They come to me from many yesterdays, from record deeds that cross the fading years, and light the landscape with their brilliant plays, great stars that knew their days in fame's bright sun. I hear them tramping to oblivion. Grandlin Rice wrote those lines as the closing stanza of a poem titled The Long Road that appeared on the last page of his final book, a memoir completed less than a month before his death. He died at 6:15 on the scorchingly hot evening of July 13, 1954, 2 hours after suffering a massive stroke while reading his mail at the Sportlight office on West 48th Street in Midtown Manhattan. Rice was the romantic mythmaker of American sports, the creator of the Four Horsemen. But in the end, he understood that everything he'd glorified during his half-century in the press box would soon be tramping with him into oblivion, replaced by the new and the modern. The best doesn't belong to the past, he wrote in the introduction to The Long Road, though his tone seemed less expectant than resigned. In the very month that Rice died at age 73, Wrecking balls were demolishing an archaic vestige of the newspaper culture he had entered at the dawn of the 20th century, Joseph Pulitzer's New York World Building. It was the last original structure downtown along what had been known as Newspaper Row, former home not just to the defunct World, but also to the Journal, the Evening Post, the American, the Tribune, and the Sun. Grantland Rice and the World, flesh and mortar of an obsolete era, gone at once. And here, suddenly, came the new age of television. By the summer of 1954, more than 350 broadcasting stations had started up in cities around the country, where 3 years earlier, the national total was under 50. In those same 3 years, the ownership of TV sets in the average American home went from extraordinary to routine, from one in five families to nearly two of every three. Television profits rose by 25% that year, while radio and newspaper revenues declined. Perhaps Grantland Rice died at the appropriate time, just when the sports writing style of his day was losing its dominant role to television as the teller of stories and shaper of myths. Rarely did the old seem so old and the new seem so new as in 1954. The cult of the modern had been growing with the century, and now it was powerful and omnipresent, and television was just part of it. Corporations and their advertising agencies offered up the gods of science and progress to be worshipped in every aspect of American life. The light of a new age blared a headline in Newsweek promoting the magazine above an eerie photograph taken in the pre-dawn dark, lit entirely by the flash of an A-bomb 7 miles away. Another ad featured an alien hero of this new age, a scientific technician in protective plastic suit and mask, handling radioactive materials next to the promise, "As General Electric sees it, the atom will produce power for homes in 5 to 10 years, and do so without government subsidy." New chemicals, magic elixirs, were introduced to the public with religious reverence. Union Carbide sold its products with a mural depicting a huge hand reaching down from the clouds, man or God, and pouring a chemical from a giant test tube onto a panorama of factories teeming with workers. The company boasted that its scientists were inventing a new chemical every month. From the earth, air, and water come new things for all of us, and new jobs. From Diamond Chemicals came an ad depicting a crowd gathered on the sidewalk of Main Street, USA, peering into a dry-cleaning building with someone shouting out the headline, "There's a revolution going on in the back room." What revolution? A new dry-cleaning chemical named perchloroethylene. Environmental degradation was celebrated as progress. Southern Pacific Railroad developed an ad campaign based on the theme of man overpowering nature in the Golden Empire that stretched from Louisiana to California. 8 years ago, some rabbits called this Texas Gulf Coast plains home, proclaimed one ad showing the before and after effects of industrial expansion. Now, a multi-million dollar chemical plant is located where the rabbits scampered only a few years ago. And right next door are other new plants supplying the booming industries of the Great Southwest. New and modern everything. New vinyl handbags and pedigreed plastic furniture. New 1954 Mercury automobiles with years-ahead styling and new ball-joint suspension and entirely new V8 engines and new colors, reds, yellows, blues, and greens that seem mixed into modern and sexy tints. New lightweight cans for soft drinks. New trailers for truck transports. New Miracle Tips cigarette filters. New tubular, all-steel folding chairs. New king-size baked enamel tray tables. New water coolers with foot pedals. New central duct air conditioning systems. New gear teeth for power transmissions. New aluminum pipes for farm irrigation. Even a new Chicago, undertaking a great new surge with new expressways and skyscrapers. It was in the spirit of the new that the New York football giants made a coaching change that year. Steve Owen had run the team for 23 seasons, since before Vince Lombardi entered Fordham. Once, long ago, the beefy Oklahoman, with the gravel drawl and massive red face, had seemed new and innovative himself, never more so than during the 1934 championship game played at the Polo Grounds against the Chicago Bears. Freezing rain and frigid temperatures that December day had turned the field into a skating rink. With his team trailing 10-3 in the first half, Owen, on the advice of the team physician, sent his equipment manager out to round up several dozen basketball shoes. The Giants wore them in the second half and gained tractional advantage over the slip-sliding Bears, coming back to win by the score of 30-13 in what became known as the Sneakers Game. But that story was a generation old. Owen was 55 now and hadn't won a championship since 1938. He was coming off his worst season, one in which his squad finished with 3 wins and 9 losses, and it seemed that the modern game had overtaken him. His varied offenses looked more desperate than imaginative. Even before the 1953 season was over, after a humiliating 62-14 loss to Cleveland, the Giants' owners, Father Tim and sons Jack and Wellington Mara, called Big Steve into the front office. "What's up?" he inquired, and they gave him the answer. His time was up. They were bringing in someone new. In the New York Daily News the next morning, a 2-column headline reported the firing, along with a prediction. Giants boot Owen upstairs. Lombardi seen new coach. The story began. Steve Owen, long renowned as the coach without a contract, yesterday was removed from the job as football boss of the Giants after one of the most disastrous campaigns in his 23 years at the helm. Steve comes off the field and into the front office following this Sunday's final game with the Detroit Lions in the Polo Grounds. It was learned by the news that President Jack Mara is seeking the services of Vincent Lombardi, backfield coach and highly regarded right-hand man to coach Earl Red Blake at West Point. Mara already has contacted Blake regarding the hiring of Lombardi, one of the famed Fordham blocks of granite who joined the Army coaching staff in 1949. Lombardi, according to the story, stacks up as just the injection of young blood the Giants seem to need. By this account, he was born in Brooklyn, raised in Englewood, and played as a starting guard for 3 seasons at Fordham. He was said to have graduated in 1937, after making the dean's list 4 straight years, and then gone on for 2 years of postgraduate study at Fordham Law School. The article by sportswriter Gene Ward had every fact wrong, except where Lombardi was born. It's unclear whether Lombardi himself fibbed about his academic record or merely never corrected the exaggerations and allowed them to become part of his resume. But from then on, most articles describing his school years asserted that he was a cum laude graduate with 2 years of law school under his belt. Occasionally, he was even said to have earned his law degree. But the most important fact that Ward had wrong, at least from Lombardi's perspective, was that he was being considered for the Giants' head coaching job. He was not. The Maras hoped to hire Red Blake, not Lombardi. Wellington Mara, who'd been Vince's classmate at Fordham, said that Blake turned them down and urged that they consider his top assistant. "Why don't you talk to my man Vince?" he said. But the Maras were hesitant to put Lombardi in the head job, worried that he was lacking in professional experience and unsure that he could be a disciplined leader. They were drawn instead to Jim Lee Howell, another of their former players, a lanky end from rural Lone Oak, Arkansas, who was almost 2 years younger than Lombardi, but had more of the aura of a pro.
He was a former drill instructor in the Marine Corps, who recently had been working two jobs. Assistant with the Giants in the morning, and head coach at Wagner College in the afternoon. Now, here is a guy who can come in and hammer things out, Well Mara said of Howell. Contrary to later reports that they were close college chums, Wellington Mara had known Vince only casually during their Fordham years, when he spent most of his spare time scouting pro talent for his father's team. Vince and Well were in Ignatius Cox's ethics class together, but so were several hundred other students. In their senior year, Mara was sports editor of the Maroon Yearbook and wrote stories about the exploits of the blocks of granite, but considered Lombardi the least talented of the seven and never interviewed him. It was Steve Owen, in fact, who first alerted the Maras to Lombardi's coaching skills. Owen had been the guest speaker at a Saints football banquet one year in the mid-1940s. "You know that guy Lombardi who was in your class at school?" he told Well Mara after returning from Englewood. "They win the championship every year." Mara became more familiar with Lombardi at West Point because of his relationship with Blake. When Army played at the Polo Grounds, the Maras invited the coaching staff to stay overnight as guests of the Giants and watch the pro game the next afternoon. Blake reciprocated by inviting the Maras to West Point. Even if they didn't want Lombardi for the top job, the Maras were interested in having him join their staff. Following Blake's suggestion, Well Mara called Vince and set up an interview at the Bear Mountain Inn. Lombardi later remembered Mara saying to him during that phone call, "We've always wanted you on the Giants, and we have an opening." According to Doug Kenna, Lombardi had told other members of the Army coaching staff that he wanted the head coaching job with the Giants worse than anything in the world, and thought that was the opening Mara was talking about. It came as a terrible disappointment when Mara instead invited him to come to New York to run the Giants' offense for Jim Lee Howell. It seemed that the football world was stocked with men who worked under Blake and became head coaches. Murray Warmoth at Mississippi State, Herman Hickman at Yale, Stu Holcomb at Purdue, Sid Gilman at Cincinnati, Andy Gustafson at Miami, Bob Woodruff at Florida, John Sauer at the Citadel. Why not Lombardi? Mara's offer might have been flattering, but it was a disappointment. Lombardi told his former classmate that he needed to talk to Blake before making a decision. Later that afternoon, in the Jim Tower office, he informed the colonel of his new job prospect, said that he preferred to stay at West Point and ask for a raise. It was only when Blake rebuffed the raise request, saying that Vince already was paid the maximum for an assistant, that Lombardi decided to take the Giants' job. "Another $1,000 would have kept me at West Point," he said later. The story that he had joined the Giants broke in the newspapers on Christmas Day. In the New York Herald Tribune account, he was praised for his football intellect. Lombardi now wears spectacles and gives the appearance of a studious professor. He is regarded as one of the smartest theorists in junior coaching. The Daily News said that he had proven himself an outstanding handler and tutor of backs and was hired to a 2-year contract for this particular talent, replacing Ali Sherman, the backfield coach under Steve Owen. As it turned out, Jim Lee Howell would rather have retained Sherman. To ensure that the two men would get along, Mara sent Lombardi down to Arkansas to visit Howell during the week between Christmas and New Year's Eve. Lombardi felt out of place walking the winter pastures of Howell's large farm outside Lone Oak, a town northeast of Little Rock. But the two men got along, especially after Howell said he would entrust the offense entirely to Lombardi. Howell also got to Lombardi through his stomach by feeding him an Arkansas version of an Izzo family meal, freshly shot wild duck and wild rice. Lombardi, as Howell later described it, just couldn't believe it, and he kept saying over and over, "You can't buy anything like this anywhere." On his return to the Giants' offices at Columbus Circle, Lombardi let out a huge guffaw when he recounted his trip to Lone Okie, as he called it, according to Wellmara. "I remember him laughing and laughing about all the cow shit in Lone Okie, Arkansas." The new job brought the Lombardis back to New Jersey. They moved at the semester break, enrolling Vincent and Susan in a new school in Oradell, 10 miles northwest of their former home in Englewood, and an easy commute into Manhattan. It was a hurried move, and Marie wasn't delighted with the new town or her new house, a split-level brick rambler, less impressive than the stately colonial at the academy. But Vince was in no mood to look around. He was preoccupied with the transition to the new job. As confident as he was about coaching, he knew almost nothing about the pro game, and felt that he had much to learn in a short time. At West Point, he had become proficient in studying film, and that is what he did now, following a more grueling schedule than ever. He brought home films of every Giants game of the past 2 years, set up a projector and screen in the den, sent the kids and even Marie down to the basement rec room if they appeared bothersome, lit up a cigarette, and went to work, often not finishing until his eyes were sore and his ashtray was littered with packs of butts. As Lombardi watched the grainy black-and-white film, he charted the movements of all 22 players on the field, using separate yellow notepads for each team's offense and defense, then indexing the notes so that he knew where to find a specific type of play. The notepads provided the original text of what later became known as Lombardi's Bible, a tome written in the language of X's and O's, the chapters stored in a brown leather satchel that he kept from the winter of 1954 until the day he died. The Giants' offense seemed anemic, but how could he revive it? He paid special attention to the games involving the Cleveland Browns, whose coach, Paul Brown, was considered the most thorough and innovative in the league. In Lombardi's Bible, the chapters charting the Browns were the Book of Revelations. From the films he'd studied from January through June, Lombardi reached two conclusions about the offense he would try to develop for the Giants. The first involved the passing game. "The big point I realized was that whatever formation I used, I had to have a flanker back," he said. "You had to have the threat of a pass. Everyone in the league was using flankers. But it was the running game that needed the most work. From pictures, my sense was the passing game was great and the running game was only a half try. Everybody said, you can't run much in the pros. Their defenses were too large and mobile to sustain a running game against them. I reasoned that the people we had on offense were every bit as big and every bit as mobile." Lombardi took his first close look at the pro athletes that July at the Giants training camp at Willamette College in Salem, Oregon. It was also their first look at him, and it's fair to say that he was more impressed than they were. Here was a pro team that had won only 3 games in the year before, yet Lombardi was awed by their athletic prowess. The gap in talent between Army and the Giants was far wider than the one between Saints and Army. He hadn't seen anything like this in all his 20 years in football. At West Point, he and Blake had operated on the theory that the bigger the man, the less quickness. But watching pro linemen in drills, he was amazed by the speed, agility, and quickness of the big men. The talents of backfield stars Frank Gifford, Kyle Rote, and Charlie Connerly impressed him even more. The fluid motion that Gifford had running, the great hands Rote exhibited catching the ball, the anticipation Charlie Connerly had in releasing the ball, anticipating where the defensive man would be. And beyond their athletic grace, Lombardi said later, he was pleasantly surprised by the mentality of the pros. The pros, for their part, were more surprised than pleased in their initial impressions of Lombardi. They considered him a college chump,
For all his film study, he wouldn't shed his Army playbook. He came in excited about delay plays in which the quarterback sprinted out and came to an abrupt stop, waiting patiently for his receivers to get cleared downfield. Maybe that worked at West Point, but the Giants knew it was unsuited for the pros, where the quarterback would never get enough time. He installed another play from Army split-T formation, designed to have Connerly, on 33-year-old knees, fake a handoff and a pass and run around end. Connerly had no desire to run, and changed the play whenever Lombardi sent it in. For offensive linemen, Lombardi taught rule blocking, another technique used at West Point. Instead of blocking a specific defensive player, each lineman blocked a zone, and if there was no one in that zone, he fanned back to another area following specific rules, hence the name. Army and other colleges were ahead of the pros in using rule blocking. It eventually became the norm in the National Football League, but the Giants had difficulty adjusting. "You had that first July that they didn't believe," Lombardi said later. "When I first explained it, they looked at one another. What's he doing?" The zealousness with which he sold his new schemes backfired at first. He appeared defensive about his credentials and kept repeating that he had worked with the great Colonel Blake at Army, as if that would impress the pros. Many of the players thought he was loud and arrogant, a total pain in the ass, as Frank Gifford later described him. Behind his back, they mocked him, calling him the Little General and Little Mussolini. In the dorm rooms, they enacted parodies of his coaching persona, his flashing teeth, his oversized feet and long arms, his barking commands, the way he lined up his blackboard chalk like a sixth-grade teacher. Hiding his chalk became one of their favorite pranks. They were not afraid to tease him to his face, in milder fashion, dropping down to old-fashioned four-point stances and snarling their faces in pantomime of the old pictures of the seven blocks. The most memorable scene at the 1954 training camp came when veteran running back Eddie Price, fed up with the way Lombardi was trying to change his pass-blocking technique, muttered, "I'm getting the hell out of here," and ran off toward the locker room. Lombardi, angry but worried that he'd gone too far, ran after him, shouting, "Eddie, Eddie, come back, Eddie!" Offensive guard Bill Austin was stunned by the scene. "Lombardi chewing on Eddie like that? We just weren't used to that kind of discipline." Young Vincent, a husky boy of 12, accompanied his father to camp that year. He cleaned cleats, brought the balls out for practice, carried the water buckets, and lived in a dorm room with a few other ball boys. He saw far more of the players than he did of his dad, which was fine with him, considering what it was like when they were around each other. "My father would chew me out in front of everybody. He'd scream that I didn't get the footballs, that I didn't do this or that," Vincent said later. This brought Vincent closer to the players, who empathized with what he was enduring. Although it embarrassed Vincent to see his dad screaming at his heroes, it was a revelation to him when he heard what they were saying about the old man. One day, standing on the sidelines next to two players, including one who had played at Army before being expelled in the cheating scandal, Vincent overheard an obscene rant against "that goddamn Lombardi." The second player gulped, realizing that the coach's son was next to them. Then, looking directly at Vincent, the first player said, "Well, the kid's got to learn sometime that Lombardi's an SOB." It was with Jim Lee Howell that young Vincent experienced his most anxious moment at training camp in Oregon. One morning, he arrived at practice several minutes late, as did a few players. Howell knew that some players had lagged behind, but could not determine which ones, and insisted that Vincent tell him who they were. The team was gathered on the practice field, watching in amazement as Howell demanded that Lombardi's son squeal. Vincent refused, and Howell dismissed him, barking, "Don't come back until you're ready." Vincent left, proud that he didn't give in, but fearful of his father's wrath. "I avoided my dad for as long as I could," he said later. His fear was groundless. Squealing had a deeper meaning to his father. It evoked the most unpleasant memory of his career, the West Point academic scandal, which centered on an honor code that required cadets to inform on cadets, a concept that offended Lombardi by running contrary to his sense of loyalty. When he finally caught up with young Vincent the next day, he surprised his son by saying that he was glad Vincent had refused to spill the names to Jim Lee Howell. Then he added, "If you had told, I'd have hit you." Even in praise, there was a threat. But this time, Vincent found it reassuring. After his difficult early weeks at training camp, Lombardi began to earn the respect of the pros. He did it through persistence and adjustment. The will to succeed was his dominant characteristic, stronger in the end than his insistence on having things his way. If he had to adjust, he would find the means. It was a talent that he exhibited for the rest of his coaching career, though it often went unrecognized, overshadowed by his public image as the implacable leader who demanded that the world adapt to him. He began roaming the hall of the Willamette dorm at night, visiting with the offensive players. He acknowledged that he had much to learn and sought their advice, help, and loyalty. He asked the veterans to work with him rather than second-guess them. "We would listen to him, and he would listen to us," said Charlie Connerly. He tried to become one of the guys, not the authoritarian boss, but the smarter older brother. They called him Vince or Vinny, not Coach or Mr. Lombardi. He drank beers with them, laughed loudly at their jokes, told them how much he wanted them to succeed. Frank Gifford was the key. Lombardi had seen him play in college when Southern Cal had defeated Army at the Polo Grounds in 1951. The field that day had been a swarm with photographers capturing every move of the graceful All-American from the West Coast. But when Gifford returned the next year to play for the Giants, he began two seasons of frustration. He never clicked with Steve Owen and felt that he was being misused, shuffled from offense to defense. There were few rewards in pro football then. Gifford, one of the highest-paid players in the league, had just received a raise to $10,000 a year. He thought he could get more publicity and money in Hollywood, where he'd been taking minor acting parts since his first year at USC. After the 1953 season, he considered staying on the coast. He was not unhappy that Steve Owen was fired. "I might not have come back had there not been changes," he said later. But could Vince make him happy? From game films, Lombardi had seen that Gifford was his ideal offensive threat, someone who could run, pass, and catch. "You're my halfback," were the first words he ever said to Gifford after introducing himself. Still, the first weeks were tense. It meant little to Gifford to play halfback in a rinky-dink West Point offense. Lombardi never lost his manic edge. Jim Lee Howell saw him pacing the dormitory roof before a preseason game, and from then on would shout, "Someone get a roof for Vinny," whenever his assistant seemed tense. But Lombardi did get the message the players were sending, and he adjusted and began building a pro-style game that let Connerly be Connerly and Gifford be Gifford, and from then on, the players were on his side. If not the dregs of the athletic world, pro football began in the 1950s closer to the bottom than the top. College football, Major League Baseball, horse racing, and boxing all drew more ink, more attention on radio and early television, and with few exceptions, more fans in the stands. College football had been considered socially superior because of its attachment to academic institutions and its pretense of innocence. The pro gritter was thought to be a mercenary playing for meal money and free beer. Ballantine, sponsor of Giants games on WINS, provided the players with a case of beer every few weeks. It mattered not at all that many college stars were also mercenaries benefiting from lucrative, if illegal, financial arrangements. The amateur in American sports was protected by the prevailing myth that college boys played only for the love of the game and school spirit. The lowly image of the workaday pro football bruiser had persisted for decades, since Jim Thorpe, the great Olympian and all-around athlete, and six owners gathered at Ralph Hayes' Hupmobile Auto Agency in Canton, Ohio on August 20, 1920, and conceived the beginnings of what would become the National Football League. But by 1954, as the spirit of the new came to dominate American culture, it seemed possible that pro football might be perceived in a brighter light. With the worship of the modern came a desire for the most technically proficient, the biggest, fastest, and sleekest of everything, the professional. The amateur ideal seemed quaint. The concept of the exciting pro was taking hold. There were only a few signs of this transformation at first. One was in Cleveland, where Paul Brown had created the model of the new professional sports team. Well organized and sharply outfitted, its players tested for intelligence as well as athleticism and treated more like corporate officers than factory tradesmen. The other was in Los Angeles, land of the new, where the Rams, led into the big time by a young publicist named Pete Rozelle, were the hottest game in town, luring massive crowds to the Coliseum. More than 93,000 fans saw the Rams play the San Francisco 49ers on the second Sunday of the 1954 season, an amazing figure. The other teams in the league that weekend drew between 17,000 and 27,000. These were still only faint glimmers of what was to come. For the most part, the NFL remained endearingly unsophisticated. When Herb Rich joined the Giants roster during the second week of that 1954 season, after being acquired from the Rams, he was concerned that neither his new team nor his old one would pay him for the first game. So he called to Benneville Bert Bell, the NFL commissioner. Bell answered the phone, listened to Rich's concern, and resolved it immediately, ordering the Rams to pay the salary. That's how simple life was in the league then. A defensive back picking up the phone and talking directly to the commissioner. No agents, lawyers, unions, league bureaucrats in the way. The NFL was not even based in New York, but housed in a small office in Philadelphia, because that was where Bell lived. He ran the league by letter and telegram, with a handful of aides helping him draft rules, keep track of the weekly transactions, and negotiate the early television contracts. Every year, Bell presented the same message to the NFL's rookies. Gentlemen, prepare yourselves for later life, because you aren't going to make a living playing football. For the league to rise in the sports world, it needed not just Cleveland and Los Angeles in the vanguard, but also New York. The spirit of the new was created in the advertising offices of Madison Avenue and preached in national magazines and on television networks, all centered in Manhattan. Most of the ad men and broadcast executives lived in the metropolitan area, and if they were to root for a pro team, it most likely would be the New York Football Giants. The Maras understood this, and were striving to change the image of the team they had run since Tim Mara bought the club in 1925 with money he'd earned as a legal bookie. In the first year of the new look, the results were modestly successful. Jim Lee Howell's inaugural team was superior to Steve Owens' last one, winning 7 games and losing 5. Attendance at home games at the Polo Grounds in 1954 was uneven, but improving as well, twice exceeding 45,000. The most significant transformation was in the coaching staff, which was run on the corporate model. Howell was chairman of the board, but two chief operating officers ran the daily operations, Vince Lombardi, the offense, and Tom Landry, the defense. There were two schools of thought on Howell's leadership style. The harshest perspective was that he had a little clue how to coach, but was saved by the two finest assistants who ever worked on the same team at the same time. Howell readily acknowledged the talents of Lombardi and Landry, and joked, self-deprecatingly, that his main function was to make sure the footballs had air in them. The most complimentary view was that he was an expert at delegating authority. Most sports writers subscribe to the second view, portraying Howell as a progressive thinker who'd adapted to the spirit of the new, which in football terms meant the era of specialized platoons. Mostly, he is the administrator and coordinator, and that apparently is the way to do the job today. Red Smith wrote of Howell. Joe King, in the New World Telegram, noted, "If the question is offense, Howell says, ask Lombardi about that. Defense? Tom Landry is the man to see. U.S. Steel does fairly well on that plan, but it is unorthodox in football and therefore suspect by some. To King, Howell's platoon system of coaching was a logical evolution. The pros have brought football to a peak of specialized skill. On the one squad, the offense and defense platoons are considered separate items and play that way. Lombardi and Landry running the same team. The Giants knew they had an extraordinary brain trust even then. Their coaching skills were undeniable, their personalities and styles as unalike as possible. Thomas Wade Landry was lean and spare, as dry as his mission homeland in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. He could be called a boy wonder of sorts. When the 1954 season began, he was entering only his fifth season as a defensive back and was not yet 30 years old, except that there was nothing boyish about him. From the moment he arrived in New York from the University of Texas, he struck his teammates as mature and rational, always thinking his way around the football field. He already had the respect of the other players when he was made a player coach, and didn't have to raise his voice to get it. Well, Mara once said that you could hear Vince laughing from five blocks away, you couldn't hear Landry from the next chair. But his mild appearance was deceiving. Landry was all science and innovation, daring to change. "He taught you not to be afraid to take chances," said Herb Rich, who played alongside him that first year in the defensive backfield. "The Rams, Rich's former team, loved to embarrass you if you took a chance. Tom would always say, 'Anticipate, get there ahead of him, go on the snap of the ball.'" Landry insisted later that he and Lombardi had a good relationship, but many of the players felt a tension between them. Frank Gifford said there was a lot of competition between Lombardi and Landry, and I don't know if it ever turned into a friendship. That filtered through the team itself. There was tension. We didn't like them, the defense, very much. And they didn't like us much, and didn't really care. We were cliquey. Lombardi, always barking, could be heard at a tense point of a game shouting at the defense, "Get the goddamn ball back for us at least once!" Landry left the obscenity-laced slaps at the offense to his players. Howell felt the competition from both sides. One day, one of them would come in and tell me he hadn't been given enough time, and the next day, the other would. They were fussing all the time. At various times during their coexistence, the defense was ahead of the offense, and when that was reported in the press, Lombardi fell into a deep funk. "It kind of dogged Vince that our offense wasn't thought of as good," Landry said decades later. "I remember a lot of times when we'd win ball games if the offense didn't do well. He wouldn't talk to Jim Lee Howell or me for two or three days." Landry came to think of Lombardi as borderline manic depressive. He gave him the nickname Mr. High-Low, because when his offense did well, he was sky high. But boy, when they didn't do well, you couldn't speak to him. They were yin and yang in almost every respect. In film sessions during the week, Landry needed a fraction of the time Lombardi took to analyze the other team. Landry was quicker, Lombardi more thorough. It was Lombardi, borrowing on the tactics he learned from Colonel Blake, who sold the Giants on the idea of taking pictures of enemy defenses during the game on a quick-developing camera and sending the shots down to the bench for instant analysis. Wellington Mara, the handyman owner who loved being of use, he would shag punts if no one else was around to do it, often relayed the pictures himself, dropping them from the upper deck in an old sock attached to a string. Lombardi showed the pictures to the quarterbacks, giving them a different view and a good idea of how the defense is reacting. Visual education is much better than telling the quarterbacks the defenses. He was also more patient than Landry in the midweek skull sessions. He reverted back to the high school teacher pounding out the chemistry lesson at Saints until the slowest kid understood it. Landry was more the calculus professor addressing graduate students. "Vin was a great teacher," said Well Mara. "He could get on a blackboard and hammer it into the lower portion of the mentality. Landry would not do that. He knew there were only three or four people in the room who knew exactly what he was saying. There was one essential characteristic that Lombardi and Landry shared. They were driven to win. Coaching together under Howell, they never had a losing season. We do or die. The old college battle cry called out to Lombardi at the end of his first season with the Giants. On the first day of December 1954, Ed Donowski resigned as Fordham's head coach, closing a difficult 9-year reign with a hapless final season in which the Rams lost all but one game. Even more symptomatic of the school's football decline were the attendance figures. Fordham's four home games at the Polo Grounds were watched by an average of only 11,000 fans. More people attended a single Fordham game against Pitt or St. Mary's during the seven blocks of Granite era than the 54 club drew all season. The football program was dipped in red, losing more than $50,000 a year. With Donowski's departure came the brief, shining idea of a return to the era when Fordham was a national power. New York newspapers the next day listed possible successors who could restore Fordham to glory, and most of the speculation involved former blocks. Johnny Drews, end coach at Notre Dame, Leo Paquin, head coach at Xavier Prep in Manhattan, Harry Jakunski, Paquin's replacement on the line, end coach at Yale, and Vince Lombardi, offensive coach of the Giants. Lombardi was at the top of the list, and the candidate who most wanted the job. His last go-around at Fordham had ended inharmoniously, but he had been an assistant then, his ambition a threat to Donowski. Now he saw the opportunity to run his own program, and the prospect enthralled him. For all his gruffness, Lombardi was a football romantic. His athletic ideal was his senior year in college, and for nearly two decades he'd been trying to recreate the intoxicating feelings that came over him that long-ago autumn. Up on the practice field, darkness enveloping Rose Hill, Butch and his mates banging and thudding and collapsing in the mud of a bloody Wednesday. On the bus, a brilliant October Saturday, rolling down Fordham Road and the Grand Concourse toward the stadium, leading the Rams in joyous song. Down on the playing field at the Polo Grounds, exhausted, hurting, Pitt driving toward the goal with the relentless thrusts of Goldberg and LaRue. But the Fordham wall still stands. To Lombardi, those sensations were the thrill of life. And even with all the power that Jim Lee Howell had ceded to him, he'd not been able to replicate them to his satisfaction. He'd not yet been fully indoctrinated in the cult of the modern. His vision was more nostalgic, linking the present with the past. But the past was going, going, gone. 2 weeks after Donowski's resignation, Lombardi negotiated a tentative salary agreement with Jack Coffey, the director of athletics. All that was needed to make his return official was a decision by the Jesuit administration on the larger question of whether Fordham would continue big-time college football. The answer came on December 15th, in a letter from Fordham's president, the Reverend Lawrence J. McGinley. "Fordham has enjoyed football since 1883," McGinley wrote, "but the unfortunate fact remains that we have run out of money for football and must balance our books. And so, at long last, our head must rule our heart." Not even the prospect of Lombardi coaching the Rams could alter that harsh reality. Faced with competition from professional football and television and travel, college football programs were folding fast in the post-war era. Small private schools seemed especially vulnerable. The once fierce Gales of St. Mary's were no more. Extinct also were the programs at Duquesne, Georgetown, Santa Clara, St. Bonaventure, Niagara, and New York University. Only Columbia remained among the teams that once made New York City a college football town. "From Rose Hill to Oblivion," read the headline of Arthur Daly's column in the New York Times, a phrase that mockingly evoked the old chant of optimism, "From Rose Hill to the Rose Bowl." Grantland Rice had vanished, and Fordham football too, leaving behind only the lantern of mythology that forever lit the path back to Sleepy Jim Crowley, the Four Horsemen, Vince Lombardi, and the Seven Blocks of Granite. One person shared Lombardi's despair over the death of Fordham football. Tim Cohane had seen it as his life's mission to carry the torch for the college game, especially as it was played at his alma mater. He was also Lombardi's leading advocate, working furtively among influential alumni to strike the deal that would have had Vince succeed Donowski. Cohane was frustrated by the Jesuits and lamented that they seemed determined to transform Fordham into a medieval study hall. But from his perch as sports editor at Look magazine, he saw a larger cultural trend that troubled him more. The cult of the modern was changing everything in his world, and he resented it. The money and power were shifting to television. The glamour of sports writing was fading along with the clubby atmosphere that he cherished. The sense that they were all pals, the writers, the players, the coaches, all in it together and protecting one another. He knew which coaches were drunks and never wrote about their off-field antics, but that ancient unwritten code was being thrown aside by younger journalists. Not that he was utterly naive about the darker side of humanity. In the pages of Look, he published stories about fixers and cheaters. But like his late idol, Grantland Rice, and his friend, Vince Lombardi, he nonetheless clung to a romantic vision of the sporting ideal. Lombardi and Cohane turned to each other for connections to that past. When they were together, they chatted in Latin, their shared language of Catholic school training, and belted out refrains of the Fordham Ram fight song. Although Lombardi could no longer attend Colonel Blake's summer camp at Bull Pond, Cohane called him from the Mother Lodge to announce the latest selections for the Bull Pond All-American team, certain that the fictitious gritters would provoke bellowing, infectious laughter from Vince. He took to calling Vince Conquering Longbeard, his stretched Latin translation of the words Vincent Lombardi. And with Fordham no longer a possibility, he pushed Lombardi for head coaching jobs elsewhere. A few weeks after Fordham dropped football, Cohane was talking to the superintendent of the new Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, who happened to be looking for a football coach. Cohane planted the seed of Lombardi, and it almost took root. The Newark Star-Ledger, whose sports editor then was Stanley Woodward, an old member of the tribe, ran a story saying that Lombardi would be the first head coach at Air Force. But at the last minute, a veteran professional coach, Lawrence Buck Shaw, changed his mind and took the academy job. It was with a growing sense of fatalism that Lombardi called Red Blake a week later and inquired about the possibility of returning to West Point. If he couldn't reach his highest goals, he thought he might as well feel comfortable working at a lower level. Blake greeted Lombardi's request with equal measures of surprise and delight. He had two openings and one larger psychological hole on his staff. He thought of Lombardi as his perfect alter ego, smart, committed, emotional, full of life, and he missed him. "Since you left, we don't have any fun around here," the colonel confessed during a lunch at the officers' club. They shook hands on an informal agreement without discussing salary. Later that day, Blake called Wellington Mara to relate his discussion with Lombardi. Mara reacted with alarm. The Howell-Lombardi-Landry triumvirate seemed to be working perfectly. It was the new deal that would restore the Giants to the championship level. Over the weekend, Well and his brother Jack talked with Lombardi three times, finally driving out to Oradell to make their case to Vincent Marie, saying that they intended for him to be head coach in New York someday. They had no intentions of dumping Howell that year, but they could reward Vince's patience with a significant raise. Marie urged him to stay with the Giants. The raise boosted Vince's spirits, but he said he felt obliged to keep his agreement with the colonel. What was the right thing to do? That Monday, he drove back to West Point to talk to Blake again. The colonel realized from Lombardi's unanimated demeanor that something was wrong. "I have never gone back on my word in my life, and I don't intend to now," Lombardi began, fibbing in both respects. He had gone back on his word before, and he hoped to now, though honorably, if Blake would let him. After hearing the details of the offer from the Maras and of Marie's excitement about it, Blake quickly resolved the dilemma. "Go back to the Giants," he said. "Forget this ever happened." 1 year later, at the end of the 1955 season, a season in which the Giants improved on the field but not in the standings, finishing 6-5-1, Lombardi was still looking around for a team of his own. Along with Fordham and Air Force, he had lost out at Penn and Washington, and his inability to land a head coaching job had thrown him into another depression. Mr. High-Low was down at the lowest of the low, moping around the Giants' offices at 8 Columbus Circle in a self-absorbed funk. "I'll never get to be a head coach," he complained to Wellington Mara. "Here I am, an Italian, 42 years old, and nobody wants me. Nobody will take me." Mara didn't really buy Vince's argument that prejudice against his Italian heritage was holding him back, but didn't argue with him, he said later. During the Christmas break that year, he sent Lombardi to California to scout the Rose Bowl. Cohane was also in Pasadena, and after the game on January 1, 1956, the two old Rams went to dinner, driving out to the Tail of the Cock restaurant off Coldwater Canyon in the San Fernando Valley. Along the way, they reminisced back two decades to the season of 1936, remembering how Fordham almost made it to the Rose Bowl that year of the seven blocks. Eventually, the conversation came around to Lombardi's coaching frustrations. "I'm wondering whether the right head coaching job will ever open up for me," Lombardi said. "I know I can coach, but the right people never seem to know it." "You'll get your chance," Cohane responded. Lombardi hoped that Cohane was right, but he felt the faint chill of oblivion. "I'm not getting any younger," he said. Chapter 10. This Pride of Giants. Vince Lombardi, in the summer of 1956, was straddling the old and the new. He turned 43 that June, no longer a young coach, but not wielding enough power for players to call him the old man. He had the same old job, but worked in a new place, not the ancient polo grounds, his traditional arena, where he'd played and coached since his Fordham days, but a shinier venue that the Maras had found for their newly refurbished New York football Giants across the Harlem River in the Bronx. Yankee Stadium, home of the pinstriped baseball Yankees of Casey Stengel, Mickey Mantle, Yogi Berra, and Whitey Ford. No name in sports was as magical as the Yankees then. The Yankees worked and traveled first class. They wore suits and ties. Their dressing room was clean, modern, and carpeted. They were not just jocks, but celebrities. And they won and won and maddeningly won. Lombardi had grown up a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. He hated the Yankees and wanted nothing more than to be like them. He and his family also found a new home that summer, moving into a comfortable two-story white colonial on Lockwood Place in the borough of Fairhaven, nestled on the Navasink River between Red Bank and the Atlantic Shore, 40 miles south and around the bend from the suburban sprawl of North Jersey. It was a step up socially, the latest safe haven for commuters, and yet old and familiar to Marie. Fairhaven was her childhood home. Marie had barely moved in when her husband drove away again, traveling north with young Vincent for preseason training camp, which began in mid-July at St. Michael's College in Winooski, Vermont, not far from Lake Champlain. Jim Lee Howell's corporate-style staff was entering its third season, and the players and coaches were exuding a newfound confidence. In the evolution of many great teams, there comes a tipping point when success suddenly seems expected. The Giants had reached that point. Operating behind an inexperienced offensive line, the backfield was gifted and deep, with veteran Charlie Connerly and Don Heinrich at quarterback. Frank Gifford and the Baby Bulls, Alec Webster and Mel Triplett at running back, and Kyle Roach shifted to end with Bob Schneider.